the Canadian Bitcoiners podcast is just two guys and maybe a guest or two discussing Bitcoin, Bitcoin equities, and the related macroeconomic space. It's not meant to be financial advice, so please, if you're doing any investing after listening to our program, do your own research, do your own due diligence, and understand that any money you invest can be lost. The show is meant for entertainment purposes only, and we hope you enjoy the program. Friends and enemies, welcome to another episode of the Canadian Bitcoiners podcast. Very special Wednesday edition, Len. We got a very important subject here and a guest who knows all about it. Maybe better than even the people who recently ruled on the subject, we could argue. I'm sure we'll hear his take on that. How you doing over there? What's a good word over in your neck of the woods?
All right. All right. It's going to rain shortly. I'm not sure if it started over there, but yeah, it was gray skies over here. Beautiful temperature, nice and warm, just the way I like it. How's it going over there, Joey?
It's not bad. It looks like it's going to rain right after this. I'm going up to the cottage tomorrow after work. So right after this, I got to run to the beer store and the gas station, the typical Canadian pit stops before they go, right? So it's once again, last minute Larry, man, like always, that's my reputation around here. My wife will tell you all about it. So before we get started, Len, sponsored by two companies. One, ShakePay, best things for Canadians to buy and never sell, though that's not financial advice. Bitcoin. They got four things going on. Number one, shaking sats. You can sign up with our promo code, Charlie Beta Peter CBP. Shake your phone every day right after you shake the other thing that you shake every day, and they'll give you Satoshis. I think it's like 50 the first day, 20 the first day, whatever it is. But after a year, if you shake it every day for a year, they give you 1,000 sats a day. I'm on like day 430 something. I got a ton of sats sitting in my shaking sats total. Couldn't be better. Number two, they got the shake squads. You and four friends that you either know from the internet or know in real life or some combination of the two or don't know at all. Hook up onto a team, spend off your CAD balance. For every purchase that one of your team members makes, you all get 42 sats each. Can't beat that. Then they have the sats back option as well. So every time you spend off your CAD balance and the first $5,000 you spend, it's 2% back in Satoshis, 1% after that. Can't beat it. And then finally, Len, they have the shake paid, which I think is probably still going on, but I don't know. I probably should check with our sponsor. I didn't. Where if you are able to, if you're able to buy something on your CAD balance with the tap or whatever the NFC thing is, there's a chance that ShakePay will just pay you for that item. We've heard about people getting their oil changed, comped. Dental work, comped. Bag of ice, comped. Subway sandwich, comped. Could be you, but you got to use your card. Give them a chance. I'm sure many of you have already, but if you haven't, sign up with our code. You're not going to regret it. Len, who's the other company?
Well, what are you going to do with all the Bitcoin that you bought from ShakePay? Why not put it on the Ledin platform and earn some interest? And if you use our referral code below and open up an account, put 150,000 sats or 75 USDC and keep it on their platform for 15 calendar days consecutively, you'll be given 10 USDC. And Ledin is also there to help you out if you have some loans that you have to get from them. So if you have some Bitcoin that you don't want to sell and you want to just borrow against it, Ledin is there to help you out with a 50% loan to value. So if you have a lot of Bitcoin, it's a lot of value, you could borrow against it. Also, with the B2X option, if you're feeling lucky and you think the price of Bitcoin is going up, well, just take advantage of it. Double up your Bitcoin stack with the B2X option. And once the price gets really high, pull out. Don't be like Elon. You're good to go. And you have a little bit more Bitcoin on your stack simply by timing the market and using the B2X option. The last thing they do have is the Bitcoin backed mortgages. It's an industry first, but also check their website because not available in every jurisdiction. But also if you're on checking the website, check out what's their borrowing and savings rates because these change on a month to month basis. And one thing I just got to make note of, Joey, this show, of course, is part of the CBP Media Network.
I always forget to say that. I know we just started it, so we'll work on that. Anyway, we got a special guest today. I don't really have an introduction for Preston Byrne. He's a lawyer on Twitter. You know him. You love him. He's a lawyer on Twitter. He's a Bitcoiner, marmot maximalist, as I've been saying in the tweets. Now Preston is here tonight because 4 years ago, he penned a very brief, though prescient, article on what? Preston, crypto property. Tell me about this. What was this thing you wrote?
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess by way of background for your listeners, yes, I'm a lawyer for my sins. The reason I'm a lawyer is because I grew up in a household of lawyers. And I remember watching my mother and father arguing over the dinner table and thinking, you know, one day I want to do that. That looks really interesting. All these things they're discussing. So I guess, you know, so I was doomed from the start. But But anyway, so I started my legal career in England and Wales, and then later did blockchain stuff over there in 2014, 15, 16. Then came back here and had to do it all over again, right? Even though I was born in Connecticut, which is the greatest state in the union, if not the galaxy. And I'm a maximalist about a lot of things. I pick my battles and I pick my little things and roll with it. But yeah, so anyway, I came back here, became admitted again. Then Stephen Pally, for those of you who are on Law Twitter, Steve Pally and I have been friends since forever. And he convinced me. He scammed me into joining his law practice over at Anderson Kill. We later scammed Haley Lennon into joining us as well. And so we've got this very like Twitter savvy crypto law practice now, where we do a lot of crypto stuff. Anyway, though, I started my career over in England, and England's one of these really peculiar. So firstly, it's a peculiar jurisdiction because from the perspective of an American, all of our legal system derives from English law, right? Not all of it, but like basically the core principles, right? The core understandings, the core philosophy is an English common law, English common law understanding of the world rather than a European civil law understanding of the world. So that's the first bit. Excuse me, I just nailed half a can of Red Bull to get myself for the podcast, so you'll pardon me for that. Anyway, so that's that, right? But as a consequence of being around for so long, like the two legal systems are a little different. In the United States, they've retained a lot of what I call common law fudges, where basically courts just kind of like they mess something up and then they go, okay, well, we've got this kind of mushy test. And because we've got the mushy test, we can kind of get away with it for a while and we'll just kind of muddle through, right? So the Howey test, anyone who's been in crypto for a long time knows the Howey test. The Howey test is a US rule which determines whether something is an investment contract, right? And if it's an investment contract, then it's a security under the Securities Act, which means you've got to register it as a security when you can't sell it in the US and you can't sell it to the public, blah, 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 right? So the Howey test is this loose four-limb test where they say if something is, if it's an investment of money in a common, so if in England, we'll back up for a second. In England, if something is a transferable security, there's a European directive which tells you whether it is. There's a list of stuff, right? A, B, C, D, E. And if it's not on that list, it's not a transferable security. Therefore, it's not required to have a prospectus, right? So when they have the crypto stuff, they've got to rewrite all their rules in order to accommodate crypto, because that kind of European influence has crept in the last 50 years or so. In the United States, though, it's kind of a much more purist common law system in some respects, because we have these mushy tests all over the place that the English have gradually one by one replaced in statutes. Similarly, from a property law standpoint, America and England are a little bit different, because in England, everything has always been owned forever, right? Like particularly with property law, which is the subject of our discussion tonight. In England, everything's been owned forever. You can trace back a piece of land, 15 generations, King Arthur like slew Mordred and this piece of land was conveyed to his sons and blah, 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 right? Literally, you can do that. You can go back and you can see the records. And the other thing that they've done is they've literally registered virtually every single piece of land in the United Kingdom. And they started doing that in 1925 under the Law of Property Act 1925. So they said, listen, we've got this big registry, and the idea is that everything, right, all of the stuff is going to appear in this register. The U.S., by contrast, in 1925 was still pretty untamed. There were large open tracts of land. A lot of the land was still owned by the federal government. So it was a much more kind of blank slate. It wasn't ossified. And so our property law evolved accordingly. So in the U.S., we've got stuff like a doctrine, for example, called relativity of title. And relativity of title means that if you have an asset and there's a dispute over the title to the asset, right? If Alice says, I own this, and Bob says, well, no, I own this too. You can assess who has the better claim, right? The court kind of has the latitude to go, Bob's got the better one. So we're just going to kind of, put a finger in the wind and Bob can have it, right? The famous case for this was a case called Popov versus Hayashi. And Popov v. Hayashi was the subject. The case was about a baseball game. And specifically, it was I think it was one of Mark McGwire's famous home runs.
Get lost.
Yeah. And so basically, they knocked the ball out of the park. And two guys, Popov and Hayashi, one caught the ball, then had it checked out of his hand. And it was knocked out of his hand and flung into Popov's hands. And so the court kind of had to figure out how to split the baby. And what the long story short is that they wound up getting like equal ownership of the ball, but the amount that they recovered from selling the ball was less than their legal fees that they that they spent in the litigation to decide who actually owned it. So it was a bit of a Pyrrhic victory. Not altogether different from the Craig Wright litigation, which was just resolved.
Listen, I can't afford to deal with that guy. Okay, I don't want to hear his name again. Fair
enough. So, anyway, so that's the U.S. right? The U.S. is a little mushier because it's kind of newer. In England, however, right, they've been around a long time and they know their property, right? And so property exists in one of two categories. Choses are things from French, right? Because it's court French that kind of leaked into everything in England. So things in possession, choses in possession, or choses in action, things in action. Now a chose in possession is a thing that can be possessed. This, right, this is a keyboard. This is a chose in possession. These are chose in possession. That is a chose in possession.
A cute one too.
This is Mr. Sloth, and he's my dog's thing in possession, right? I'm sorry, buddy. Did I wake you up? So anyway, sometimes you can wake up a chose in possession. I just did. So a chose in possession is a thing that's tangible, right? And can be possessed. So a house arguably is a chose in possession. Land, right? And then you have things in action, choses in action. Choses in action are things which are enforceable in a court, right? In front of a judge. You've got to bring an action in order to enforce your rights. And so virtually everything else that you can think of in the land of documentary and non-documentary intangibles is a chose in action. So if you have a contract, right?
Oh, I'm sorry. I really did wake you up. I'm
terrible. Totally worth it, though, because I know some of your users, some of your viewers are like, what dog? How did this?
For sure. It's going to bring people to YouTube from the audio side, 100%.
So anyway, a chose in action is virtually any other kind of property until Bitcoin, right? So if you have a loan with your bank, in the hands of the bank, the loan is a chose in possession, is chose in action, excuse me. Because if you default on the loan and the bank wants to enforce it, they've got to go to a court, they've got to recover, blah, 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 take their security, et cetera, et cetera. Another example of a chose in action would be intellectual property, right? If you have a trademark, then you need to register that mark. And once the mark has been registered, then you have a right if someone infringes on it, which you can enforce by going to a court. Similarly, a carbon credit, right? That's a chose in action. That's something which is recognized by a court. If you have a copyright, right, that's another piece of intellectual property. A copyright is something which subsists the moment that you lay it down in tangible form, right? So if you write a book, you have you don't have to register or anything. You do in the U.S. if you want to sue on it, but that's beside the point. But you get the rights, right, the copyrights, as soon as you lay that thing down in tangible form. As you're recording this, right, you're creating copyrights in this episode, right? So those are rights which you would enforce in the court. But it occurred to me a couple of years ago, I was like, all right, people were referring to Bitcoin as a digital bearer asset. And my background in, hey buddy, you're a digital bearer asset. Yes, you are. So it's a little digital teddy bear asset. That's right. So anyway, Bitcoin, on the other hand, doesn't really meet those descriptions, right? It cannot be possessed. So one of the first, and England is... England is historic. Okay, what do you want? You want to go down? Okay. Sorry. Here you go. There's your bed.
This is a struggle that all dog owners go through, by the way. This is why my dog is never allowed in the room, because he wants to do something with me, but he never knows what that thing is exactly.
Yeah. So I mean, we'll see if he figures out and gets bored and wanders off. So I'm hoping you will. But you know, if I really, really wanted to, I would have put him in one end of the house and then gone.
I like the dice.
I was just you know what? I'll roll the dice this time. See what happens?
And like, it adds character to the stream.
Anyway, so where were we? But Bitcoin, right? It's not a bearer asset because it can't be possessed. So there was a great HMRC memo that came out in 2014 when people were asked, when I enter the United Kingdom and I have a balance of Bitcoin, right? If you come in with greater than 10,000 pounds sterling in money, in cash or other financial instruments or other assets, when you cross the land border of the United Kingdom or an airport border, you've got to declare it, right, to the customs officers. And if you've got it, presumably it will then be seized. But you know, that's another point. But you've got to declare it. And someone wrote to HMRC and said, listen, if I'm crossing the border with a balance of Bitcoin, do I need to do it? And HMRC wrote back, no, you don't. You don't need to declare it because Bitcoin exists on a decentralized network and you merely are holding the keys. Right. So you haven't actually walked into the United Kingdom with the Bitcoin. The Bitcoin's kind of already here. And so that was a really, for those of us who were around at the time, there were maybe like 10, 20 lawyers who were really very active in the space at the time. We looked at that. We're like, huh, someone at the revenue and taxing agencies were some of the first government agencies in England and the United States in particular, were the first government agencies to really wrap their heads around crypto really well. FinCEN in the US was also very, very quick to do so. The SEC was very late in the game, incidentally, as it happens. But FinCEN and the IRS and HMRC were pretty quick off the line. So that gives you some example. That's an example of where Bitcoin differs from a bearer asset, right? Something you can carry. Similarly, though, if you describe Bitcoin as a documentary intangible, like a security or a bond or cash or anything like that, you can't really, or a note, whatever. It doesn't really meet that definition either, right? Because if I have a Bitcoin and let's say I lose my private keys, God forbid, I have this terrible boating. I actually did have a terrible accident on the boat just this morning and everything was gone. It was terrible. Again, firearms, crypto, my other poodles.
Oh, no. Yeah.
For those of you watching who don't know what a boating accident means in crypto, I suggest you Google boating accident.
You damn well, if you're watching this show, you damn well better know what that is.
So it's an inside joke. It's very, very funny. Trust me. So I'm a lawyer. So anyway, so long story short, it's not something you can sue on, right? There's no, I can't call up the CEO of Bitcoin and go, hey, you know, Craig Wright, I'm sorry, I'm kidding. I can't call up the CEO of Bitcoin.
Listen, we're not big enough for him yet, but at some point, you know, if the trend continues, precedent, my back catalog is already going to get me into tons of shit. I'm just going to add this to the list, okay?
I've been editing it. Don't worry. Slowly but surely, I'm editing it out. All the stuff we could potentially get litigated on.
Excellent. Excellent. So I'll try to keep you guys out of trouble on this podcast. Anyway, so you can't sue anyone on it, right? So there have been some rumblings. I'm not going to say specifically which ones or whence they emanate. But there have been some individuals who have said that they have certain fiduciary interests in the Bitcoin network. And they've said, well, potentially, you know, maybe BSV is the proper way to do this. And we're going to go get injunctions against blah, 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 blah. Right. But ultimately, what you can't do with Bitcoin or any truly decentralized system is you can't get a court order and you can't then, as a practical matter, right? There's no one you can really serve it on. Conceivably, maybe, right? You could get a court to turn around and say, yes, I'm going to issue an injunction, which is going to be binding on every single Bitcoin node in the world. And if you don't follow it, then you're in violation of this injunction. My hunch is that injunction would not be very persuasive or convincing to those nodes which were not in the country where it was issued, and that those nodes would just carry on doing whatever, right? So Bitcoin kind of exists separately from the legal system in that sense. So you can't hold it, right? Mm-hmm. And you can't enforce it in a court. And the problem under English law is that there are two types of property. There are types of property you can possess, and there are types of property that you can enforce in a court. And so a couple of us noticed this back in the day, and I wrote a blog post to just kind of like put down a marker back in 2018, like, hey, I've noticed this. And just last week, the Law Commission published a 500-page paper, and they consulted really extensively for this, right? So this is not like my idea, which suddenly the Law Commission has like adopted as its own. Like, they've got a rogues gallery of law firms. We were consulted at Anderson Kill, Allen and Overy, bunch of English legal academics. So this idea has now caught on and actually gotten a lot of traction. There are judges who have decided this in their decisions. And basically, a lot of pretty smart people, I like to think we're pretty smart, kind of, maybe. I mean, I'm dumb, right? I'm dumb. I was just early. But there are a couple of other smart people who happen to agree with me and happen to agree with the Law Commission and happen to agree with one another, that at least in England and Wales, that two-tier property system is actually a three-tier property system now, and that Bitcoin exists in a new category of property law. And now, what does that mean? Right. And I'll shut up in a second. So property is not, when we say property, we don't just mean stuff. Right. If we're talking about stuff, then Jupiter is stuff, right? It's a mm-hmm. big load of stuff. There's more stuff on the planet Jupiter. There's 1,000 times more stuff on the planet Jupiter than there is on Earth, but we don't call it property. Why? Right. Well, firstly, there's the Outer Space Treaty, which says that it's a global, you know, it's part of the global commons. But second, property doesn't just mean stuff. Property means the relationship between people and stuff, right? People and objects, people and things which are capable of being possessed. So when we're talking about things in possession, the reason all those rules arose about how we possess stuff is because people possess stuff. So the courts needed to come up with a framework in which people could deal with that possession of said stuff. And the reason we have shows as an action is because we allow people to sue over things and intangible stuff. And so that is another set of rules which came into being. And with Bitcoin at the moment, kind of every major jurisdiction is kind of fudging it, right? They're doing things by analogy, or they don't need to really deal with the underlying nature of Bitcoin. Because if I, let's say I put some Bitcoin on an exchange, for example, I put the Bitcoin onto the exchange and the exchange then decides they're going to take my Bitcoin, right? And not send it back. Two things happen. One, fraud, right? Because they obtain something of value under false pretenses. And then the second one, so that's a claim I have against them and potentially a criminal action that could be brought against them. But secondly, there's a contract there, right? So there's a contract between me and the exchange in the form of the exchange's terms of use, in which the exchange says, you give us your money, we're going to hold on to your money. And then when you withdraw, we'll send it back. So you turn around and you sue them for breach of contract and misrepresentation and various other things. So that kind of a dispute, which is where most crypto disputes arise, for the longest time has operated at that level of abstraction, right? It's one level of abstraction higher than going in and saying, okay, hold on a second. Let us suppose we have a user, they've got a wallet. The wallet is, you know, they generated the keys offline. Everything is being done offline. What is the thing that they actually hold? And what are the, you know, next, what are the consequences as a result of that? And, you know, everybody's kind of just fudged it, right? They said, well, there's actually a contract here, right? Well, there's actually a, you know, some type of fiduciary relationship here. Oh, well, that was confidential information of some kind. And so therefore there was some equity which arises in favor of the person who is cheated here, right? So they've kind of used these little workarounds to describe that relationship. And so what this really is from the Law Commission is a really important body in the United Kingdom, because MPs are on the whole morons. They're not like, not all of them, right? That's unfair. MPs on the whole are politicians, right? They're not legislative draftsmen. And parliamentary draftsmen are actually really good at their jobs, right? The Law Commission are policy people and academic people who propose research, propose and draft the first draft of every law in the United Kingdom, right? Basically, the first draft of every law on the books doesn't get written by an MP. It gets written by the Law Commission. And then what happens is it gets passed on to the government, and then the government proposes it and introduces it as legislation, which then gets passed by Parliament. So what they have basically said at the Law Commission in this draft, you know, consultation response is that they think that Bitcoin and things like it constitute a third category of property, A. B, that the current legal system is not well suited, right, to handle this, right, Bitcoin as property, and that there are likely changes, and they propose a bunch of them. Like, it's 500 pages, and they haven't had time to read and digest it all. But essentially, they've said things like, you know, custodial relationships. We're going to have to define, you know, what the relationship is between a cryptocurrency holder and a custodian like an exchange as a default position when that user turns around and puts the money on the exchange, right? So if we were talking about something like Celsius, prime example, Celsius went bankrupt in the US, the bankruptcy courts went, well, you're all unsecured creditors. Celsius owes you money. There's no relationship of trust. Law Commission goes, hold on a second. Maybe we want to impose one, right? Maybe we want to impose such a relationship. And if that were the case, then what would happen is the Celsius company, right, would be a trustee, which means that those assets wouldn't form part of its bankruptcy estate, wouldn't be distributed to non-secured creditors. They would go back to the customers and the users where they belong. So, excuse me. So that's pretty much it, right? So that's essentially they've agreed with this very, very old blog post of mine where I said, something smells funny. What if this stuff that we're handling isn't actually stuff in the sense that we have defined stuff up until now? What if it is a new type of stuff? So I'm very pleased to say that I wasn't crazy. I was over the target. I wish I'd been a little more over the target with, my decision not to stack up on Ether back in 2014. But at least in this, it's okay when you're over the target on something. It means that you can trust your instincts a little more than you did the day before. And that's it. So basically, the Law Commission has published this absolutely, I hesitate to say, but really, it's a wonderful report, which is a really extensive survey of English and common law jurisdiction, property law, as it applies to crypto. I'm still in the middle of digesting it, but long story short, it tells us that there's probably going to be some significant changes down the road in the way that we interact with this stuff, in the way that legal systems interact with this stuff, because the current rules, in their estimation, and they're some of the best people in the world to make that determination, are just simply not up to scratch.
So, okay, first of all, that might be the best instance of rolling downhill we've ever had on the CBP. Most guests take them like a little bit to kind of find their footing and before they really hit something they're passionate about. And
he went right into it.
I can't believe that. That was outstanding. That was like 22 hard minutes on property law and the history of property law in the United Kingdom.
Keep chugging, Preston. We got you for a couple hours here.
Yeah. So kudos for that. Now let me try to ask a smart question here. I think one of the things I've seen on Twitter in the last, few years when it comes to new legislation and attempts to quantify Bitcoin in terms of property and in its relationship to the Howey test, things of this nature, I always see two different factions on Twitter. One that says this is the thing that's going to take us to 100,000 or 1 million a coin because legislative clarity is what's missing. And the other that says the laser eye crowd. I count myself.
I don't have laser eyes, but your dog does though.
Your dog does. And so that's one crowd, but the other side is more skeptical, not necessarily non-believers, but they're concerned about state interaction with Bitcoin, the asset, and Bitcoin, the network. What are the, in your view, what are the possible outcomes here that people should be keeping an eye on, both on the sort of bull side and also on the bear side? What do you think about that question? Is that something you can answer now, or is that something that's worth talking about? What is the story here?
What are the potential? There are a billion. There are many, many, many potential outcomes, which will vary, from place to place. One thing which I found is fairly helpful as an English lawyer, as an American who became an English lawyer, like basically got most of my education in Scotland and England, and then came back and had to do it again, is that I find that people who haven't done that, particularly Americans or just straight up English lawyers or straight up American lawyers, it's very difficult to see outside your box, right? Because you just don't know that there's an alternative way of doing things. It's like, listen, this is the legal system. This is how it's structured, right? And so we can't really think creatively. So with stuff like property law, like there are many different ways to crack this nut, right? I will also say that one thing I appreciate is that law is fundamentally, it's a local phenomenon. Right. Mm-hmm. So there will be different rules everywhere, and all of them are kind of iterating right now at high speed in different directions. So there are going to be different approaches to this stuff. Everybody's kind of rolling the dice. And eventually there's going to be a model which is struck, which is very, very popular, which works with the trajectory that crypto is going in. And the trajectory, and when we say trajectory, what do we mean? We mean adoption on the one hand. We also mean actual utility and usefulness. On the other, right? Like, so the penetration of Web3, as it's called, into everyday life all around us. I think if you were talking in 2014, 15, and you were saying, well, we've got all like EOS and all that crap that was being printed, and no disrespect to the guys at EOS, they made a couple billion dollars more power and got off with a $24 million fine. Like, good for them, I guess. I try not to get fined in my day-to-day life. It's just a personal rule of thumb. But anyway, that stuff was useless, right, back in the day. I don't think there was really a future for a billion Ponzi coins that were going to, perform exactly the same function. What we're starting to see now, and, I don't really have a dog in this fight, so before you jump down my throat on any of these coins, I don't hold any of them. We're starting to see stuff where the token is being associated with real world functionality. And that real world functionality is providing a real service that people are actually using. Polygon is super duper popular among NFT projects or anything that's cribbing on Ethereum, right? Because it's one of those EVM, EVM duplicate chains. Helium, right, is another that project takes a ton of flack, but it does something useful in the real world. It hooks up LoRaWAN radio nodes to the internet, which is, not a lot of people use that particular part of the spectrum, that, which is why there was an article someone wrote the other day about Helium. They're like, well, no one's actually using it for fees. And I'm like, yeah, but that's because nobody uses LoRaWAN for anything.
It doesn't really matter whether or not it's being used widely. What you're saying is that it's being used for something. There's a tangible case. It's functional in some respect in the real world.
Well, like if you went back to 1980, right? And so we're on, what is this? StreamYard is the platform, right? There are a billion video streaming, not a billion. There are hundreds probably, and of which there may be a couple of dozen leading streaming platforms on the internet. if you went back in 1980, right, and you said, well, I'm going to start a video streaming platform, people would have like looked at you like you were on the planet Mars, right? And they would have said, well, surely there won't be a need for more than one of those. But we've got tons of them, YouTube, Cozy, this, Periscope back in the day. So like they're all over the place. So people have different options and there are different businesses serving different segments of the market in different ways, right? And so that's one thing that I suspect we're going to see with cryptos is that there are going to be different services running on commodity hardware or server hardware or various other things. Filecoin, right? Another example. Filecoin gets a lot of stick, shall we say, because it's got something like 30 exabytes of hard drive space, providing like 20 gigabytes of storage, decentralized storage. There are some regulatory issues with it and other stuff that we don't have to go into here, but like fundamentally someone's taken that project is a stab at providing a piece of the functionality that AWS provides. Right. So everybody, and I don't think you provide AWS on a global decentralized basis. Right. I just don't think that happens, but you can probably take pieces of it. You can probably take things that need to talk to the internet, but don't need to talk to massive numbers of people at the same time. That can probably run on something like that. But we just don't know, right? Because we don't have the luxury of seeing over the horizon and understanding what's going to happen next. Does that make sense? So I mean, the law, as the law relates to all of this, right? The law is reactive, right? It's not proactive. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you get proactive legislation. Generally speaking, proactive legislation is bad law. So I'll give you one example. The Wyoming DAO law is the absolute worst trash fire piece of legislation I've ever seen. We can go into it if you want, but it's
well, like, yeah, you got to tell us what it is, because no one here knows what it is except you. So.
All right. So like DAO. So DAO was another thing. We were doing DAOs when everybody else didn't know what they were. So my first, I think we were the first enterprise blockchain startup in 2014. We were called Eris Industries. Our little team, we forked Ethereum POC 3 and we said, hey, what if you put like all of the tooling to control a blockchain into a smart contract in the Genesis block? You could do things like control block times and, you know, revoke keys, you know, at any time and do this and do that. So we did that and sold software to banks for a little while and didn't make a whole lot of money because banks are really cheap and their procurement cycles are like stupidly long. we were a startup and yeah, no one was going to be like, oh, cool. Yeah, no, just like handle all of our bonds. You start up, it's been around for like 8 months. So that was a stupid idea, but it was fun. The rewards are really the friends you made along the way. So anyway, that was interesting. Where was I going with that? Where were we going with that?
The relationship with the law and these tokens that, you know, whatever function they serve is not, it's not the most important thing, but that they serve the function.
Well, so the law is reactive, right? So DAOs, that's what it was. So DAOs, so essentially back, that project started as a DAO or a decentralized or distributed autonomous organization. And we figured out pretty quickly that the DAO thing wasn't really going to work in most commercial applications, because what happens is if you're building something and you call it a DAO, right? And then someone comes in later and they've got a problem with what you've done from a regulatory standpoint or a civil law standpoint or something else. They're just going to look right through the DAO and they're like, cool, it's a general partnership. You're all jointly and severally liable for what's going on. So he said, maybe you want to insert an entity somewhere in there and then run the entity that way. And maybe that'll work. So Wyoming was like, great idea. Let's do that. So they passed this thing called the DAO law, which basically said that you can have an LLC in Wyoming. And if it will be a DAO, if you specify in the certificate of formation that it is to be a DAO, and it can be one of two types of LLC, it can be algorithmically managed or member managed. But if it's algorithmically managed, then the members are voting on the algorithm, which means it's back to being member managed again. It was this stupid, frivolous law that like was bound to be abused. The first company that then used it was called the American Crypto Fed DAO, which said that they were, I mean, you can imagine what line of business.
What a name.
Right. And I believe, and I could be wrong, but I believe they got smacked around by the SEC in very short order thereafter. So like basically people are running around saying, oh, well, we've got a DAO now. And it's like, no, you don't have a DAO. You've got this cargo cult version of a company that you've essentially said, listen, you've essentially taken a company. You've not done any of the work on your business. You've put a smart contract with a token on the Ethereum blockchain and you've said it's a DAO now. And you haven't done any thinking about what the actual underlying business is for the thing that you've just launched. So the Wyoming DAO law basically is a law where an LLC in Wyoming can say it's a DAO, and therefore it will be called a DAO, and there is no real functional difference between that LLC and any other kind of LLC. But a bunch of people who wanted to start things called DAOs decided to form their LLCs in Wyoming. And Wyoming has like funky LLC default rules too. It's not like Delaware. They've got screwy things like a non-compete covenant for co-owners of an LLC, which is automatically implied by law. So you go and incorporate, what happens is you go and incorporate a Wyoming LLC, and then you have a dispute with your co-founder. And then all of a sudden, And then all of a sudden, you're like, "Oh, what? I can't compete with the guy because I'm a member in an LLC, and we haven't waived it in our articles. You know, why didn't we think of that?" It's like, "Well, because you formed an LLC in Wyoming, and nobody lives there." So, like,
why we hire lawyers?
Wyoming is a great place. It's full of great people. Just don't form your LLCs there. Just do it in Delaware, like everybody else ever in the history of the world, the beginning of time. That Delaware was not around in the beginning of time. That's an exaggeration, but you get the idea, right? So like people are trying these, and there's a lot of this in law where people try to do, or in commercial law around blockchains, where you get guys who are trying to really innovate on the edges on the legal structure instead of doing what they should be doing, right? Which is innovating on the product. And so we usually have a preference, a very strong preference, to be like, listen, keep it simple, stupid. You know, do not, you know, I don't care that your lawyer said that you should incorporate a Kazakhstani foundation, right? Because of the, you know, the supposed benefit. Seriously, not.
It's almost like you were in the room when we incorporated all the stuff you're saying.
Don't
leak any information, Joe.
You're sitting there and like, why did you incorporate in as like a nonprofit in Armenia? Could you please mean that? And it's like, well, you know, our lawyer said that there's this weird, blah, 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 and it's just, oh. Anyway. So anyway, DAO laws are bad, but the getting back to the original point, law is really good when it reacts. It identifies a problem, right? The problem comes up once. That's interesting. Comes up twice. Oh, it's still interesting. Comes up a dozen times. Okay, we got to fix this, right? And so eventually there's a solution, at least in the common law tradition, right? A court can either do it or the legislators can do it, right? If the problem's bad enough, the legislators get involved. If the problem isn't so bad, a court gets involved, right? And a judge just says, listen, I'm just going to, you know, reason by analogy here and just wrap this bit of existing law around this other thing. And we're going to apply that. And that's the precedent. You know, Bob's your uncle. We're done. So that's the way that things usually work. It's a reactive process. If the law gets too far ahead of itself, right, then you run the risk that it's like over-engineering a software product, right? Or like the Homer from The Simpsons. Remember that car, the Homer, that one Simpsons episode? So you build something which you think is going to solve the problem, but you haven't actually had there's not a problem. The problem either isn't as big as you thought it was or important as you thought it was going to be, or it just doesn't exist. Right. And with new tech, I think that that's a big risk. So as a lawyer who works in tech, you know, it's sometimes fun to think about what the law should be, right, in the future and what laws we could have. But generally speaking, it's a better idea from a structural point of view for not to encourage people to get ahead of themselves and write the laws before the products and problems that relate to them exist. So on that boundary, there are all kinds of compliance issues that come up, right? And our job is to help clients navigate those as best they can. Anyway, so I've said enough on that point.
I want to double back to the data objects part. And the environment today, it's unique. And people are upset with governments of the day. And some examples, rising costs and noticeable scarcity in goods such as baby food. And you also have officials flying on jets, but also wagging their fingers at us to not drive our car to go to work. So there's a lot of people that are upset with the governments of the day. So this comes from the Law Commission, which is a branch, from what I understand, of or part of the British government. How could we sell this to Bitcoiners that knows what's going on in the world? And also we have our keys to ourselves when we're not going to sell it or bring our wallets with us on a boat because we know it's going to happen. How do we sell this as something that is good for Bitcoin going forward?
Yeah, the Law Commission people who wrote this aren't really bureaucrats. I mean, they work for the government, but they're really like law nerds, right? They took the nerdiest lawyers they could find, like who are really, really into legal history and all the rest of it. And they're like, cool, we're going to give you a job just like being really good at understanding the law, right? They, here you go. So, and there are academics who work with it and all the rest of it. So the Law Commission is a group of people who are laser focused on understanding English law, right? All of it in its totality, you know, beginning to end. So that, and that's, so I don't think this is, they're really not a political body. They obviously have their politics. There are certain law commissioners actually that I've crossed swords with in the past on issues like free speech, because there are some law commissioners who've said, listen, we think that we need this new online safety bill or this new speech restriction bill that creates these new speech crimes and blah, 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 blah. And you know what? In their capacity as public officials, they should rightfully be criticized for putting forward stuff like that. Here, though, and really with anything commercial law oriented, English law is not very politicized. It's not politicized because the judiciary isn't politicized, right? So judges are appointed, right, by the government. They don't have the power to override parliament. Parliament is supreme, right? So their job really is just follow the law and keep your interpretation to a minimum. There's no written constitution, which they can then turn around and say, well, I have this funky interpretive framework, which says that what the government's doing is illegal, right? Doesn't happen in England. If Parliament says it's illegal to smoke on the streets of Paris, it is illegal to smoke on the streets of Paris. That's the end of the discussion. So the role of the judiciary is very different there than it is here, which means that the role of people proposing these rules and the people who are applying them, the judges, is also very different than it would be in the United States and possibly also Canada. I know you guys have the Fundamental Charter up there, which is something where it's the Fundamental Charter is kind of a halfway house between the U.S. Constitution, which, of course, is a very robust civil rights document, and then the European Convention, which is a very weak human rights document, which applies to things like freedom of speech and various other civil liberties in the United Kingdom, which was implemented in the domestic law by the Human Rights Act 1996. But really, it's not. There's not a lot that you can do if some British decision or law, if a law of Parliament tramples on free speech, right? And firstly, the European courts in Strasbourg won't say that it did, because they have this thing called the margin of appreciation, where they say, well, you know, you have freedom of speech, but if the state kind of thinks it's sort of necessary to get rid of your freedom of speech, that's cool. As long as they kind of give it lip service, they're fine. And that's the margin of appreciation for things like that in the United Kingdom, because they're still part of the ECHR. So anyway, I digress. So the Law Commission, they're not the baddies for the most part. They're not the baddies. And I think we can be very comfortable. And there are some real degens who are working at the Law Commission. So I think we can be pretty comfortable with, and the report is wonderful. Like I've only gotten really into certain bits and bobs, but it's a really wonderful piece of legal analysis. And I really encourage everyone to read it. And there's really not a scrap of political. It's wonderful to see, because if this document were produced in the United States, it would be absolutely ruined by partisan dribble. but seriously, like in the U.S., like government agencies just can't help themselves these days. This document's really fabulous. I really recommend reading it, and I have a lot of confidence that the UK is actually going to be in a position to lead from, you know, a global crypto regulatory perspective in the next 5 years as a result of reading this document.
That was my next question. Do you feel like they're the leaders? So you think that they are or are about to be? What is the, you know, next step now as far as the process for this new tier of property law? Seems like a big step to me. Is it as big a step as I think? What's the next step for those guys?
So again, law follows, it doesn't lead, right? So the crypto market is growing by, it's probably doubling every 10 to 12 months, maybe a little faster, maybe a little slower in a bear market, maybe a little faster in a bull market, right? So, and when I say doubling, I'm not talking about the market cap. I'm talking about the number of people who use it. So back in 2014, we were maybe 900,000, a million. That's when I started really getting active, was in mid to late 2014. There are possibly a million people holding it. I saw a number from Blockworks saying that this time last year it was between 200 and 400 million, right? So it's possible maybe we're at like 500 or 600 million now, right? But we need to get to a billion, 2 billion, 4 billion. Things get really interesting at that point, right? It's at that point, it's everywhere. It's not people saying, oh, I heard about Bitcoin. It's that everyone has it. And the question is, how long is it going to take us to get there? So in that environment, I think if we look back and we ask ourselves, you know, how Europe has traditionally positioned itself vis-a-vis the United States, I think there's likely that there's going to be some regulatory arbitrage between Britain and the US, right? Or the UK, I should say the UK. The UK and the US in the near future. So the UK will see where the wind is going, They'll have documents like this to hand to assist them. And when the time comes for them to look and do some lawmaking, they'll have stuff like this, right? These 500 very well-researched pages to review. It's going to inform their opinions, and it's going to help guide them and steer them in one direction or the other. In the United States, there is no government body that's really done an analysis like this. So we have kind of a piecemeal things being done by the federal government in the legislative chambers, right? Little bill here, little bill there, but no one's really thinking about crypto in a comprehensive way, right? And like, how can we just fully integrate this into American life? And so I think the UK is positioning itself to, when there's a next big surge in interest in crypto, which will happen as surely as the sun rises in the morning. I mean, this is only going in one direction, even in the bear market. So it's just a question of waiting and seeing. But with stuff like this, the UK is basically demonstrating that it's going to be in a really good position to capitalize on the next big upswing in the crypto markets when that should come. Might come in 6 months, might come in 12, might come in 24. You know, we've seen a lot of bear markets in our day. You know, it could be tomorrow and it could be in years. I don't think it's going to take that long, just based on exponentials. So I think that I think this is likely to happen sooner rather than later. And at that point, right, the legislators are going to then look to people like the Law Commission and say, listen, okay, we've got this stuff, we've got this problem, which has now come up now that crypto is such a big chunk of the economy. You know, how do we address it? And they'll look at stuff like this and they'll come up with an answer.
So it sounds like to me that this captures essentially what is Bitcoin, but not just Bitcoin the asset, but even Bitcoin the network. So moving forward, then, how is this going to potentially impact businesses that operate with the Bitcoin network, like such as Bitcoin miners, or maybe companies that build upon the Bitcoin network, maybe Lightning or you name it? Are they going to be impacted at all positively by this?
I think so. I mean, Lightning is a really good example of a network where you're going to have additional assets which are tied back into Bitcoin, So backing up, actually. The third category, I describe it as crypto property with a K, right? Mm-hmm. It's third category of property. The reason I call it that is because the original cryptos, right, in Greek, it's secret, is of course where that comes from. And I think that the defining characteristic of the property, of this category of property, is the exclusive knowledge of the secret required to access it, right? And then the lawful, you know, non-fraudulent state transition on the blockchain that gives someone else that secret, right? Or transfers it really to another secret key. So when I send a Bitcoin to Bob, I'm not really like creating a new secret. I'm saying, hey, Bob, you've got a secret. I'm going to now move this crypto asset so that your secret is in control rather than my secret. So it's the knowledge of the secret, which is to me, I know something you don't yet know. So that's why I call it crypto property. The Law Commission and a bunch of UK academics call it a data object, right? And so I have a little bit of a problem calling it a data object because we already have data objects. They're called objects. I think that term will probably not survive, even though it's the term that they chose to use. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what these things are going to be called, but the data object describes and I've got it just here in some notes. So the data object is their description of this critter, right? This entity. And so they've said that it has three characteristics. The first one is that it's represented in an electronic medium, including the form of computer code, electronic, digital, or analog signals. Query, have you guys ever heard of an analog signal in crypto? I'm not sure an analog signal cuts it, but that's what they said, right? So they're very open about it. Maybe it's like in like strange, what is it? Close Encounters of the Third Kind. That's an analog signal. So maybe if you hum a certain sequence, right, you can transmit your Bitcoin. If you're one of the humming aliens from Close Encounters of the Third Kind. So that maybe that works. Law Commission, yeah, hit me up. So that's one. So it's got to be represented in an electronic medium. Makes sense. You can't have a data object that's represented on a physical medium, because if you do, guess what? You've got a shows in possession. Mm-hmm. Two, you've got independent, you've got a shows in possession, and you might have something like a database right. So if you etch that on a record or a copyright or something like that. So if you etch it on a physical object, you've already got something that the law knows, has cognizance of. Two, it has to have an independent existence. And what do they mean by that? They mean it has to have an independent existence of the purse of persons, right? It can't be a person or something that's in a person's head or anything like that. It has to exist externally to a person. And it has to have an existence independent of the legal system, right? So it cannot be recoverable by legal action. So, which is an interesting point, right? If it can't be recoverable by legal action, So you can compel someone. If let's say I steal your Bitcoin, Joey, right? I steal your Bitcoin. I break into your house. I steal your Bitcoin. I come home. I say to my dog, I was like, Zorro, what are we going to do with this Bitcoin? We've got all this Bitcoin now, this big pile of Bitcoin. What do we do? And he's like, send him a letter, right? And say that if he doesn't send us a pile of treats, we're gonna spend the Bitcoin on a Lambo. I'm like, okay, fine, I'll do that. So send your letter, dear Joey. If you don't send treats, I'm going to spend your Bitcoin on a Lambo. Zorro, right? Paw print, sign, right. Set. You get this up in Canada, and you're like, hey, what is this? What is this, a boot? I am outraged. It's a holder. You get on your bear, and you ride down. CMT outpost, and you go meet with Officer Dudley Do-Right. And you say, Constable, I've received this letter, and he's taken my Bitcoin. And he says, if I don't send him dog treats, he's gonna spend it on a Lambo. It's problematic, isn't it? This won't do. Now, let's assume I'm in Canada for the purposes of this argument. Now, they can do a couple things. They can get hands on me, right? They can just go and arrest me, right? And say, okay, you've been arrested, hand over the Bitcoins. They can go get like an order to seize it, right? There, you go get an in rem order against the property itself, and then they could try to enforce that order against me or against some other person who's in possession of it. But what they cannot do, right, is they can't tell Bitcoin, hand it over, right? Bitcoin doesn't respond to that kind of influence. Now, with that said, right, there has been a very longstanding discussion in the world of cryptography, not just cryptocurrency, about the possibility of backdoors that would allow exactly that, right? Now, before everybody jumps down my throat, I don't think that's a good idea, but that's just like, that's where that discussion goes. It's like, well, what if you had a Bitcoin, but the Bitcoins could only be moved if there was a valid court order signed by a judge, right? Doesn't work, right? Because no. Ultimately the system is not going to know the difference between a Russian hacker and a judge, right? Whenever that system gets compromised. So Bitcoin achieves its, we call it censorship resistance, right? If you don't have the private key, those coins aren't moving. So that's what we mean when we're saying it exists outside of the legal system. It is non-responsive to legal pressure. People are responsive to legal pressure, right? Things in action, they can seize my house, right? And sell that to make you whole. If it's, let's say there's $100,000 in Bitcoin I stole, they could say, you know what? You know, that's it. You're $100,000, it's a judgment debt in favor of you. Go enforce it, go take his house, something like that, right? Mm. Whatever. So all kinds of stuff the courts can do affecting real world assets. They can get after possessions, they can get after shows as an action. They cannot get after the Bitcoin. They can punish you for not handing it over. But fundamentally, if you destroy those keys or you don't have the keys or you're not willing to give up the keys, those Bitcoins ain't moving. Right. So that's what they mean by an existence, that second factor, which is an existence independent of the legal system. And the third factor they call is rivalrousness, right? Which they also say is a characteristic of all property, right? But by that you mean that the use is not unlimited, right? If one person has a Bitcoin, another person cannot double spend it, right? They're not gonna have if used by one person, it doesn't necessarily prejudice the abilities of others to make equivalent use of it at the same time, right? So if you, Len and Joey, you decide, you know what, here's a balance of Bitcoin. We're going to just share it between us and we're going to spend it on whatever we want. We're going to agree that these 30 Bitcoins, it'll be a stupid agreement to make, but you could make it. You could say, listen, I've got this Bitcoin and we're going to spend it any way we want. And I can spend as much as I want. You spend as much as you want. It's our present to ourselves. And let's just, whatever. Let's only spend it on drugs. I don't know. Whatever people spend money on with Bitcoin. Who knows? Let's only spend it on flowers, right? We're only flowers for our yard. And you'll sign a deed saying, we agree that we're only going to use these Bitcoins for flowers in our yard or something like that. And so then what you do is you say, right, fine. You spend it, do whatever you want. You both have access to that pool of Bitcoin. You said there's some contract which governs how you're going to access it. You both have access to the private keys at the same time. So like rivalrous means, right, that fundamentally it's not something like let's say public domain image, right, where let's say I have your transaction ID, right? So the transaction ID, which, so I transfer the Bitcoin to you, it's got a transaction ID. It indicates what your public key is, right? That's pure information, right? Mm-hmm. I can reproduce that as much as I want. I can transfer it to other people, but that doesn't, when I transfer it, say, hey, guys, guess what? I just moved Bitcoin to your wallet. Here's an email containing your transaction ID and the public key address I sent it to. I'm going to delete the public key address and this email so that like I can't see it ever again, right? So I do that. And then I was like, actually, I really want to look at it one more time. And I remember what it is. I type it in to, whatever it is, blockchain.info, and look it back up, copy paste it, right? That's an example of information being transmitted, but information not being transferred, right? If it's transferred, it means I've transmitted it and I've moved it beyond my possession, control, or knowledge. That's what rivalrousness means. So those three things, data represented in electronic medium, existence independent of humans and the legal system, and rivalrousness are what they say are the three characteristics of so-called data objects. I think that's almost right, right? But I think within the rivalrousness category, and I'm going to send some comments back to them on this. It's an open consultation. There's a call for comments. So I'm going to finish reading this 500 page behemoth, and then I'm going to send it back. but essentially, there's something missing there, which is that, and I haven't quite put my finger on quite what it is that I don't like about their definition, but I'll figure it out. The rivalrousness piece has to do with the knowledge of a secret, right? And you can share the knowledge of the secret if you want. Not a good idea, but you can. But the secret is sometimes it's capable of being ascertained, right? So Peter Todd made a Bitcoin address where if you found a SHA-1 collision, you'd get access to the coin balance, right? So, which is pretty easy to do. But like you could have a puzzle like that where you say, listen, if you figure out the puzzle, you get the coins. Mm-hmm. In which case, right, it's presumably knowable. It's knowable by anyone, but only known by a few. In which case, it's kind of a weird arrangement where you say, listen, I acquired the answer to this puzzle, right? I found the hash collision, so I therefore have got the answer. However, I haven't transferred it out of this address yet. Have I assumed control over it? Is it still crypto property at that point? Is it mine?
You have the secret that is otherwise not yet known, right? Yeah.
But what happens if I'm like, oh, well, I found the secret. Great. I'm going to go in my living room and I'm going to enjoy the fact that I found the secret. Nice, cold Canadian beer here on this canoe. And I'm going to enjoy my, this experience, and it's going to be great. And as I'm sitting there drinking my wonderful, Canadian beer, all of a sudden, right, a moose comes along and answer.
Hitting them all, man.
And he goes, he spirits the Bitcoins away while I'm drinking my beer out on the lake, because I'm in Canada. So like all of a sudden, oh my God, where are my coins gone? Well, the moose took it, right? Or some other person found that hash collision and they took it. So I didn't quite exercise dominion over the coins in enough time that I prevented someone else from taking it. There's something about that which needs to be included or at least accounted for in this definition of data object, which I'm not sure. There are two things. One, I don't think you can have an analog signal constituting a private. I suppose you could, but nobody does. So TBD. Because how would you access the private key in that case, right? Would you have a microphone? You have to convert it to a digital signal in order to access the coins anyway. So in my comments, I'm gonna be like, what are we talking about? Like a
beat? I like the exercising dominion thing. Like that's a good term, is it not? I mean, I'm not a lawyer, of course, but it seems to me like that is a good place to start at least.
So the Law Commission, unsurprisingly, dealt with this in their analysis. And basically they said the control is not a necessary, right? It's a characteristic of a data object, but it's not necessarily defining. It's not definitive, mm-hmm. right? If you have control of a thing, that's a good indication that maybe you've got a data object on your hands, but it doesn't necessarily mean that the thing is a data object. So if I have control over a balance, let's say someone builds an air miles system, right? And I've got air miles on that system and it runs on basically a line for line clone of Bitcoin, right? Except it's a line for line clone of Bitcoin without mining and someone else, JetBlue runs the consensus out of their offices. I've got something that works in every respect, like a data object, like a Bitcoin, like crypto property. However, it's not crypto property. Why? Because it's a claim on something else, right? It's evidence of a claim to air miles from JetBlue, which are issued by JetBlue. So if you go through that three-part thing, is it data represented in an electronic medium? Tick, yes. Does it have an independent existence, right? Independent from any particular owner? No, X.
No.
Right. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, is it rivalrous? Probably not. Right. I guess it is on the system. It's recorded as being separate, but ultimately JetBlue could turn around and just say, we've got to print all the air miles we want. You know, it doesn't really matter. So there you see how by simply changing what it means, you can have something which is an identical clone to Bitcoin. Right. But depending on the relationships, and again, the first thing I said about property at the beginning of the night was property is not about stuff. Property is about the relationship between people and stuff, right? So I have Bitcoin, that's a data object. That's crypto property, right? I have JetBlue miles on a line-for-line Bitcoin clone. That's not crypto property. That's a security, right? Or that's e-money or something else. It's not this decentralized third category property, even though if you didn't know who was on the other side of it, right, it would look exactly the same. So let's say they cloned Bitcoin. They said your Bitcoin balance will be the same as your JetBlue miles balance. We'll add a couple of zeros to make it a little easier to do. Because, I mean, it wouldn't be like, yeah, I've got 0.005 miles. So we'll port your Bitcoin balances. All Bitcoin users will get free JetBlue miles and one for one, you know, whatever. And the blockchain's the same and the headers are the same and everything's the same. Your balances will go up and they'll be redeemable on JetBlue. That's not a data object, even though you have cloned the Bitcoin code base to do it, simply because the relationship has changed.
That's fucking, Preston, you fucking crushed, man. That was a fucking hard hour out of you. And there's a lot of stuff in there that I think I'm gonna have to listen back to, because as I mentioned, I am not a lawyer, and I didn't understand your American accent for most of it. I got to go back and translate a lot of that stuff into Canadian. So, but you crushed. So Preston, I got to ask you two more questions. Shoot. Unrelated to Bitcoin. Okay. The first one,
yeah.
I haven't run this by Len yet, but you, I think, are at least supportive of some kind of marmot conservation fund. Is that mm-hmm. true? You've talked about this before. What is it? Yeah. What is the name of that fund?
So it's called the Marmot Recovery Foundation.
Foundation. Okay.
Yeah, so it's marmots.org. marmots.org. They're Canadian, actually. And so out in Vancouver Island in Canada, there are these adorable little marmots. If you don't know what a marmot is, it's a squirrel the size of a house cat that's basically the most adorable rodent in existence. They live in the mountains. They're hyper endangered. And this group of really super Canadians have brought them back from the brink of extinction. I think there were 30 in the wild at one point. Now there are a couple hundred. And they've got, you know, marmot breeding facilities, and they're cloning a marmot army, which is they're going to use to, you know, defeat the separatists and the place of the Republic and the galaxy, and which will eventually become. Anyway, no, that's a joke. They're not breeding a marmot army. They're just breeding adorable marmots and releasing them into the wild out in Vancouver Island. And they do really, really good work. So we've raised a lot of money for them. We, the internet, have raised a lot of money for them through various things. The Chia Project, which is a UTXO-based sort of hard drive space-based space proof of space and time cryptocurrency. So it's a new thing started by Bram Cohen and my friend Gene Hoffman. So Gene and Bram, very graciously, the project created Marmot Coin, which has been a long-running joke of mine on Twitter for years. And so we were giving away Marmot Coins if someone would send in proof that they donated $150 to the Marmot Recovery people, and they were donating $100, $200, $500. So we raised a couple grand for them that way in December. Then another project on Chia, an NFT project, has redirected all of its royalties to the Marmot Recovery Foundation. And so they've raised a couple grand for them that way as well. So, but yeah, it's a really good charity. They're really good people. Marmots.org/donate. If you want to just chuck them a couple of bucks. I know they're really grateful for it. They notice when people donate online, and so yeah, it's a good cause. So you should go throw money on it if you've got it.
I don't see Canadian Foundation. Yeah, where's the Bitcoin donation option?
I'm on the page right now. I don't see it.
Yeah, there isn't one. I mean, crypto custody is hard. So it's look.
If only there was a lawyer friendly to their cause who could help them navigate these tumultuous waters. I don't know.
Yeah. You know what? I'm just a super fan, right? I'm just a super fan that's been retweeting their stuff for years and years and years. So definitely, listen, I pay them in fiat. Everyone else can too. It's a good cause, and I'm sure they could use the help. So yeah, chuck them some money if you got it.
Think about it for sure. If you were listening to the show, it's a great Canadian foundation. That's the reason I asked. Now, Preston, I got one last one for you that we ask all our guests. Okay, you've been very gracious with your time, but you have to answer this question before you go. If you are in a parking lot, okay, you're in your favorite pair of shorts, running shoes, whatever, tank top, t-shirt, you decide, okay. Mm-hmm. And 40 yards away, there's a finish line, nice clean checkered flag. On one side of you, we got three contestants for today, Len. On one side of you, fellow Blue Check elite Haley Lennon, and on the other side of you, your buddy Steve Pally. Who's winning that 40-yard dash, and by how much?
Oh, I'm gonna smoke him by at least like 10 seconds. 40 yards.
You think both of them down?
I think I definitely win that probably by a second, maybe. I don't know.
I don't think anyone's won a 40-yard dash by a race by a second in all of recorded history.
I cycle every day. I don't necessarily run, but I definitely. I mean, obviously, I'm the funniest of the three, and obviously, I'm the most social media savvy, and obviously, my Twitter account is the best. So it only makes sense that I'd also win the foot race. You know, unless some subterfuge happened, like they, I don't know, stole the election or something like that. Steve and I have very different politics. So we make fun of each other constantly in the office, which is always fun. So that one was for him, but no, I mean, I guess I'd win.
Maybe, it's a maybe. Beating. It's a beating. That was a quick response. Preston Byrne, find him on Twitter. What's your handle? It's just Preston J. Byrne, right?
Yeah, Preston J. Byrne, PrestonJByrne.
Find him on Twitter. Send him lots of messages about house cat size, rodents, and yeah, we appreciate your time, sir. Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks.
You crushed, buddy. Way to go.